Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome back to Year in Review. Today we're going to talk about the management and what's new in the management of colorectal cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Arvind Dasari from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, and Dr. Anwar Saeed from the UPMC Kilman Cancer Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, part of the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Today we're here to talk about colorectal cancer, and there's a lot going on, as there is in almost every part of oncology today. We will be discussing the use of unapproved agents and regimens today, so check out the prescribing information for the approved products for more. As with all of our year in review programs, I met with the faculty individually in the last couple weeks to record a presentation going through some of the best big papers of the year in colorectal cancer. Both of those talks are in the chat room if you want to click them and download them and check it out later. And when we send out the recording here today, we'll also include those as well. This is really where you should get all the, here are the papers that are covered in these talks. They go through all the data. We're going to show some of the slides here today just to kind of alert you to it. Hopefully you'll be able to check out these presentations, but today we're really going to focus on what it means to clinical practice as well as taking care of patients. Here's where we're heading today. I was inspired by listening to these presentations to kind of talk about the concept of the Research to Practice paper of the year. I'm going to see with the faculty whether they agree with me or not. Then we'll jump into the papers that were reviewed there. Well, first we'll talk about a new and really exciting area of checkpoint inhibitor therapy, immunotherapy for localized MSI-high disease. Then, of course, we're going to talk about circulating tumor DNA assays, something we talk about, seems like every time we do a program on solid tumors, but, of course, particularly here with colorectal cancer. We'll get into checkpoint inhibitors for metastatic disease. Hey, looks like we have something happening, particularly because of Anwar's great work at the Phase 3 STELLAR trial looking at an IO plus TKI's zanzalintinib. We'll get into some other papers, including the Breakwater paper and a bunch of other studies this year if we have time. But first, just a word about what I think might be the paper, or I guess we could say papers of the year. So faculty, this has been kind of my ChatGPT week. I think on Monday, a friend of mine took a picture of my living room and sent it to ChatGPT and said, do you think you could rearrange the furniture there? And it came up with some pretty good suggestions. So on Tuesday, we did a program on small cell cancer of the lung, and I asked ChatGPT to come up with a good metaphor for small cell, and the faculty thought a wildfire sparked in dry grass was appropriate, and we, of course, got into the biology of small cell. Then last night, we did a program on breast cancer, and I asked ChatGPT to come up with a graphic on agree, disagree, and in between. And here's what they came up with. And so last night, the faculty was getting into whether or not they had a green face or a red face based on, they were kind of red face for Serena 6, but we'll get into that later. So I was having such a run there, I thought, well, last night I asked ChatGPT, what do you think is the most important study in oncology in the past year? And interestingly, the other times I asked ChatGPT for answers, they came up with right away. This time, ChatGPT kept thinking and thinking. It took a while to answer the question. And I could see what they were looking at, too. Interestingly, they weren't looking at our stuff, which I thought was interesting, and I'm glad to hear it. But when I asked it to narrow it down, here's what they came up with. Breakwater, we're going to talk about that today, looking at ENCOBINI and plus chemo and BRAF disease first line. The Matterhorn study, durvalumab chemo, gastric cancer, FLAURA2 chemo plus osimertinib, Delphi 304, the tarlatamab study, the bispecific Serena 6 presented last year at the plenary session in breast cancer, and the INAVO study and looking at AKT inhibitor breast cancer. Two big CLL trials, Amplify looking at short-term use of acalabrutinib is venetoclax and CLL17 looking at short-term therapy. The Majestic trial in myeloma, looking at a lot going on in oncology nowadays, looking at, again, a bispecific teclistamab and daratumumab. And I can see they were looking at other studies too, the enfortumab vedotin, pembro and bladder, and the DESTINY trials that were presented at ESMO. But the interesting thing is what our RTP trial of the year was not on the list at all. So Arvin, agree, disagree, or in between. Here's my paper, and just to lead into it, I'll just mention that in 2010, the ASCO meeting, there was a paper presented by Dr. Jennifer Temmel from MGH showing that early hospice care at diagnosis of metastatic non-small cell lung cancer led to a survival benefit. And this led to Dr. Tom Lynch, who discovered the EGFR mutation, to say, hey, if this was a drug, we'd be using it. I'm not sure 16 years later whether we're using it or not, and I'm not sure whether this is going to be used the way it should. But Arvin, I'm saying this was the paper of the year, structured exercise after adjuvant chemotherapy for colon cancer. Can you talk a little bit about what they looked at, what they found, what you think it means, and do you agree this is the paper, at least until ASCO, this is the paper of the year?
Yeah, this is a really exciting publication that came out that enrolled patients with colon cancer and who had a stage 2 high risk or stage 3 colon cancer, who had completed adjuvant chemotherapy and were enrolled onto this trial. And they were randomized between the control group of where they were given education material about exercise and the experimental or interventional group where, in addition to these education material, they actually had exercise done, some of which was under kind of monitoring and supervision. And the results were really, really compelling and striking, with improvement in the primary endpoint of disease-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.72. And even striking was the improvement in overall survival with a hazard ratio of 0.6. And again, to build on what you said about if this were a drug, we would give it. I mean, these numbers are similar to some of the drugs that were approved in this setting. So I absolutely think this is practice changing and safe, cost effective, can be applied immediately. No FDA approvals required. And by all means, I think this is something we should all do. And my reaction to this, if it's not obvious already, on that scale that you used, green face with two thumbs up.
So, Anwar, actually, we're going to bring this up at the ONS meeting because I think nurses can also be very helpful. And I think the amount of exercise, I believe, is like 3 or 4 hours of moderately intense exercise a week. Is that something you think is going to, you know, permeate oncology in the next year or so, Anwar?
Yeah, I totally agree with Arvind that this is I would consider it you know, the trial of the year too. It's just, you know, something that we're not used to see in oncology, and if it's if it's a drug, we'll use it. But you know, exercise is cheap and I think feasible. There has been a lot of interest in exercise in oncology after the presentation of this trial. There is a lot of academic institutions now launching exercise in oncology programs in their cancer centers. And so that tells or speaks of the importance of this.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to understand the biology of what's going on with this. So I would say trial of the year part B, speaking of if this was a drug, we would use it, was just from the GI meeting, Arvin. Baby aspirin in patients with PIK3 alterations. Can you explain here what happened?
Yeah, that appears to be the theme of the year in the adjuvant setting for colorectal cancer, in that these simple, easy, readily available interventions have had outsized and surprisingly impressive benefits. So in this trial, the Alaska trial, patients with colorectal cancer were screened for alterations in the PI3K pathway. And they were placed in one of two groups based on where these alterations were. If they were in the PIK3CA gene, exons 9 and 20, they were group A. And if there were alterations in other key genes within the PI3K pathway, they were placed in group B. In total, there were about 40% of these patients. Each of these groups were randomized to aspirin versus placebo for 3 years. Aspirin was dosed at 160 milligrams, or two baby aspirins, easy to remember. And again, the results were striking, with a reduction in the recurrence risk by almost 50% in both of these groups. So really striking results. And overall, this therapy was also well tolerated, with minimal increase in toxicities. And again, I think this is absolutely practice-changing, easily, readily available drug that everybody is familiar with. The one thing that we do need to remember that will need to change in the way we practice the care of patients with colorectal cancer is that we would need to do sequencing of even early stage tumors as well to get this information.
Yeah, well, I mean, AKT inhibition is now part of prostate cancer management, so those patients are getting tested. We'll see whether or not it comes over, or you can really just offer aspirin to everybody without testing them. All right, let's get into some of the papers you went through in addition to these two. We're going to start out with the issue of checkpoint inhibitors for localized MSI-high disease. And, of course, Anwar, we saw at the ASCO meeting something we've been looking for a while now, adjuvant IO in MSI-high disease, the ATOMIC study in phase 3 and stage 3 disease. We're not going to go through, I think everybody at this point is familiar with the fact that there was a significant benefit there. I'm just kind of curious right now, how are you thinking this through, Anwar? Is it something you've been able to actually access? Have you been able to get adjuvant IO? Are you offering it to most of your patients with stage 3 disease? What about high-risk stage 2?
So looking at the study population here, it was tailored to the stage 3 population with MSI-high and deficient mismatch repair colorectal cancer. So in the adjuvant setting, I think the study is clearly supporting the addition of atezolizumab, a PD-L1 inhibitor, to standard of care chemo. As far as current evidence, this is the only, I would say, phase 3 trial, the only phase 3 evidence that we have right now to support the use of immunotherapy around surgery in the resectable population. And so in those patients, post-surgery for stage 3 disease, I started using immunotherapy plus chemo as standard per this trial. I've had scenarios where insurance may not approve it, but not a common theme. So I use it in most of my stage 3 colorectal cancer population. We're still waiting for FDA approval, obviously, but we used a paper and we used a presentation and then the paper that was recently published in New England Journal of Medicine. And then as far as extrapolation to the stage 2 high-risk population, we have done that. And actually in those patients, sometimes I favor using the immunotherapy alone without the chemo, given chemo may not lead to additional benefit in stage in the stage 2 setting. So that's what I do in real-world practice.
So, Arvind, curious about your thoughts about that. If you have a patient who has, quote, low risk stage 2 but has a positive ctDNA, would you try to use this strategy? And what about using just IO without chemo? You have an older patient or patient with comorbidities, really doesn't want to keep going to chemo. Would you consider IO alone also?
Yeah, I do think that, especially in patients who are unable to do cytotoxic chemotherapy, it would be very reasonable to offer them immunotherapy as part of their adjuvant regimen. And there's this really interesting study out of Memorial Sloan Kettering where they enrolled patients with a positive ctDNA assay, so MRD positive, who were MSI high, and these patients were treated with immunotherapy, and a significant proportion of these patients actually had clearance of their ctDNA and improved long-term outcomes. So a small study by no means is that definitive, but kind of, again, supporting this approach that we discussed.
So another big paper that came out this year in terms of localized disease was from a Memorial study that we've been hearing about, starting out with the New York Times, I think. Use of dostarlimab, IO therapy, immunotherapy, MSI-high rectal cancer, where, of course, they saw such incredible all CRs. And they also looked at other cancers. We were talking about, we were at the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting this weekend, and then they see a lot of MSI-high endometrial cancer. There was actually only one person in this study, but there are now studies going on in endometrial cancer. So again, Anwar, in your practice right now, have you been applying this strategy? Or are you having patients? Are you seeing, is everybody in your practice? I've had a couple of people presented to me that weren't CRs. Are you seeing all CRs? Do you utilize cell-free DNA in the decision making at all in the localized rectal setting? Any thoughts about dostarlimab in this situation, Anwar?
Yeah, I think the data is compelling, and it's also supported by other neoadjuvant trials that used immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant space that also showed impressive results. However, you know, the 100% complete, the 100% clinical CR there is, I think, you know, I think there's nuances there that we need to see replication of this in other studies, which, in my opinion, was not seen. There is some real-world retrospective reviews that looked at the same population that received immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting, the rectal cancer population that did not replicate the 100% clinical CR, and so I think you know, this might be questionable. But having said that, it's a deep response that they've seen with immunotherapy alone. So I don't have any reservation regarding this approach. I think this is where the future is heading, and we're waiting for the validation phase 3 studies. But I have used dostarlimab outside of a clinical trial setting in real-world practice.
So also interesting that we're going to see a study using dostarlimab, either CAPOX or dostarlimab as well, in this setting now in the colon cancer, MS stable, or I think that maybe this is MSI high. Yeah, no, this is MS stable. So again, Arvind, any comments about, again, use of immunotherapy in MSI high patients? Is rectal cancer different? Is it more sense? I mean, 100% CRs is pretty impressive, although maybe it's going to end up being a little lower than that. Any reason to think that MSI high rectal cancer is more sensitive to IOs and, say, MSI high endometrial cancer?
Not sure if we have compelling data that suggests that response to immunotherapy could be driven by the site of origin of the tumor. I mean, again, as Anwar pointed out, this is a very controlled clinical trial setting. So real-world data and other trials suggest that response rates may be lower than what was noted in this trial. So I would completely agree that for MSI-high rectal cancer, immunotherapy is absolutely the way to go.
Just kind of curious, Anwar, any thoughts about neoadjuvant IO in MSI-high colon cancer? You have a patient with a bit bulky disease, you want to shrink it down. Have you ever used that strategy?
Yeah, I think there is also evolving data, not a phase 3 level data, but the evolving data from phase 2 trials that utilized IO-IO approaches in the neoadjuvant setting in this population has shown very promising outcome. So the niche trial is one, and then there is a BOT-BAL combination trial that the NEST study that was done in the US. Both are small studies with not more than 100 patients enrolled into those trials, but the outcome was very impressive, and particularly the NICHE trial, which had was presented earlier a few years ago, and then we had the mature data presented recently and published, and showed really promising long-term data for this population. In fact, I've had examples of patients who relocated to the US and was on NICHE and still doing okay, kind of, in complete remission with no evidence of recurrence years after completing their peri-op, their immunotherapy without having surgery. And so I think, it's very promising, and I think we're going into a new era of hopefully shying away from surgery for this particular population. But if you look at those trials, the NICHE trial had a cohort of microsatellite stable population there, and the results there was also very impressive. And when we look at the immunotherapy outcome in microsatellite stable disease in stage 4 versus the peri-op early stage disease, it clearly shows that the stage is a factor when it comes to immunotherapy response. And so if you go to early stage setting, particularly neoadjuvant as opposed to adjuvant, you will get deeper responses. So I think we are heading to a future of potentially incorporating immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant space for MSI high and possibly as well for MSS.
Yeah, and again, the Starlimab study is we talked about before. Actually is MS stable disease. Arvind, any thoughts about neoadjuvant therapy with MS stable disease? And we're going to talk later on about metastatic disease, where we're starting to see some really interesting data. But what about in the localized setting? Do they respond better, or have you ever treated a MS stable patient with neoadjuvant IO, Arvind?
As Anwar pointed out, there does appear to be some differential response in early stage tumors as compared to more advanced tumors to immunotherapy, perhaps reflecting some differences in the tumor microenvironment, making the early stage disease more responsive to immunotherapy. Compelling data. But for microsatellite stable colon cancer, I think treating them with neoadjuvant immunotherapy should be on a clinical trial until we have definitive data.
So also, Arvind was bringing up the fact that at the ASCO meeting, we saw new stage changes for colon cancer. And hopefully in the future, it looks like the classic staging is going to change a little bit based on TNM. But he was also saying the question of whether or not it's not going to be too long before we're going to see cell-free DNA incorporated into our initial evaluation. I mean, it's pretty much there. It's just not in the staging system. So, Arvind, you gave an incredible review in your talk when I met with you on all the different trials looking at ctDNA. We're not going to go through all of them, but maybe you could just sort of summarize. I'm just going to kind of flip through them as you talk. But, I think the two big issues clinically that people want to know about, that's really what I want to focus on with the two of you, is at a very basic level, are there situations where you can identify patients who normally you would not give adjuvant therapy to, where you would if you had a positive MRD assay, or would you use a more aggressive treatment with a positive ctDNA assay? But then also, are there situations where you might de-escalate treatment? A patient with stage 3 disease, like a T2N1, for example, where you might use cell-free DNA to de-escalate or even not use therapy. So, Arvind, what are some of the key data sets that have influenced the way you approach these two questions? And what are you doing right now? I know MD Anderson, you're probably testing everybody because you have all these trials going on. But from a clinician's perspective, where do you think right now? And I guess the guidelines maybe haven't exactly caught up yet to what's going on in practice. But right now, where do you see ctDNA fitting in, both in escalation and de-escalation of therapy, Arvind?
Yeah, so I think to answer that question, it'd be helpful to quickly just go through the data sets that we have at hand to set the stage. There have been several real-world cohorts that have published data, including this one by Dr. Stacy Cohen and group that looked at kind of a cohort that, again, reinforces what we know already, the incredibly prognostic effect of ctDNA monitoring, and also suggesting that these patients who have positive ctDNA, when they are treated with adjuvant chemotherapy, their outcomes actually improve. Building on these real-world cohorts, we have data from randomized trials, including the Dynamic 2 trial that looked at ctDNA-guided versus standard of care approaches in stage 2 and stage 3 colon cancer. The Dynamic 2 trial was in stage 2 colon cancer and showed that the ctDNA-guided approach was comparable or non-inferior to the standard of care approach, and also that the amount of chemotherapy that was used in the ctDNA-guided approach was much lower as well. And again, in line with other data that we have, this data set showed that the use of adjuvant chemotherapy actually cleared ctDNA and prevented recurrences in these patients. And addition of oxaliplatin provided some incremental benefit. And the other study that the Dynamic group did was in stage 3 colon cancer patients. And again, a similar approach, kind of using ctDNA-guided approach versus standard of care approach. And in the ctDNA-guided group, they did both escalation and de-escalation, depending on whether the assay result was positive versus negative. In stage 3 colon cancer patients, these approaches did not really pan out in that there's no clear superiority or non-inferiority depending on which arm you looked at. But the thing to remember with these trials with ctDNA is that you're not only asking a clinical question, but you're also testing the performance of the assay. So kind of when you're using a much older assay, the question that you're asking might get diluted. So as of now, I would say at least for stage 3 colon cancer patients, we need to be cautious about making these decisions in all patients. Perhaps in select patients, you could think about using this approach. But for most patients, the answer should be to enroll them onto ongoing clinical trials.
So, Anwar, or not getting back to if this was a drug we'd use it, an incredible study that a lot of people are really taking to their practice now, looking at celecoxib in cell-free DNA in stage 3 patients. I think when they looked at this originally, they didn't see any benefit, but they went back and looked at patients with cell-free DNA, and they saw that they actually did benefit from celecoxib. Did that persuade you, Anwar? Is that, again, a strategy you're using in your practice?
I think, yeah. I think there is, data. Now we've seen the aspirin data, for example, with the PIK3CA. So I do believe that there is a subgroup of patients with colorectal cancer that might benefit from anti-inflammatory approaches. So the family of agents of aspirin or next generation, the COX-2 selective blockers would benefit a certain subset. And I think ctDNA, using ctDNA as a marker to define who would benefit is a right strategy.
So, Arvin, I think I shared with you another ChatGPT experience that I had, which is I asked ChatGPT, if we did cell-free DNA and assays on patients with stage 2 colon cancer without high-risk features, okay, so there, we know that the risk of the likelihood of positivity is very low, 5 or 10%. But there are a lot of people with stage 2 disease, particularly now with all the screening. And so I was curious whether or not it would actually have a significant public health effect, even though it's not common. And so ChatGPT estimated that out of the 52,000 to 54,000 people dying of colon cancer in the United States every year, we might theoretically, if we treated the patients who had low risk but otherwise but positive ctDNA, we might be dealing with potentially 10,000 deaths a year. So in other words, 10,000 death people die a year of colon cancer who didn't have adjuvant therapy because they were considered too low risk. So you think that's enough of a reason to think about ARVN doing testing and people with stage two or otherwise don't have high risk factors?
Yeah, so the risk of positivity with these MRD assays increases as stage goes up. For stage two colon cancer, it's probably around 10%-ish, I would say, post-surgery. And these patients should absolutely get adjuvant chemotherapy. That current standard of care is a fluoropyrimidine in combination with oxaliplatin. The guidelines are currently kind of awaiting, I guess, kind of robust randomized data to be included, incorporated into these practice recommendations. I mean, along those lines, kind of just to highlight that clinical use of these assays is only possible here in the U.S. I mean, these assays are really not available for clinical use elsewhere outside of the U.S.
Yeah, and I don't want to give the impression either that I just go to ChatGPT and believe anything it says. It's one thing if it's decorating my living room, but in terms of data. But I did, we actually submitted an abstract to the GI ESMO meeting. And I was talking with Dr. Eric Van Cutsem, who runs that meeting, because about the survey we did that showed that in the U.S., where they do have access, we do have access to these assays, particularly the Signatera tumor-informed assay, that people, investigators are using it. And I, again, brought that argument up to him about the public health implication. And he thought the numbers actually were valid. He was going to go back and take a look at his data from Belgium. Anyhow, we'll see where that heads, but to me, it's a really fascinating opportunity to maybe impact a group of people we didn't know exist. This all came out of the fact that we were doing a program in breast cancer with Dr. Lars Puzdai from Yale, and he did some work with the SEER data in breast cancer showing that 23% of deaths in breast cancer occur in people who present with stage one disease. So that was what kind of gave me the idea to think about it in colon, although breast obviously is very different. ARVN, you had a thought?
Yeah, I just wanted to also highlight the potential for novel drug development in this space using these ctDNA assays. We've seen from these observational cohorts and randomized trials that even after we identify these patients, when we give them the current standard of care adjuvant chemotherapy, while we're improving outcomes, by no means are they optimal. They're still, the majority end up having a recurrence. So I think we also need to develop more effective drugs for patients who are ctDNA positive.
So actually, in the chat room, Dr. Rudolph said she has a 72-year-old patient with positive ctDNA 8 months post-surgery for stage two, and 4 months later had peritoneal mets, wants to know how long to continue chemo. But I think just the idea of using cell-free DNA. And another really fascinating strategy based on cell-free DNA, on Warren, I love to hear the NSABP. I know you're at the NSABP. We used to work forever with the NSABP, Dr. Fisher and breast cancer, Dr. Walmark, years and years. But of course, NSABP does colon cancer research as well. You want to comment on, I think it's the NSABP Foundation study looking at people who are post-treatment, post-adjuvant therapy, ctDNA positive, looking at treating those patients with IO-based therapy.
Yeah, so as Arvind highlighted, I think, we have accumulated enough evidence to support that minimal residual disease assays are prognostic, and it's time to look to utilize those assays in interventional trials. And so there has been a lot of interest from industry to develop interventional trials in this space, not just in colon, but I see an evolution of those trials in multiple other solid tumors as well. But in the colon space, I work with the NSABP Foundation, and so we've recently launched an adjuvant trial in the minimal residual disease setting for patients who have colorectal cancer, who are stage 2 or 3 or stage 4 oligometastatic disease, who underwent definitive therapy, including chemotherapy, surgery, or chemoradiation for the colorectal, for the rectal cancer population, and had positive minimal residual disease assay using the Natera assay post the definitive therapy. So those patients could enroll on the trial. The trial is a platform study with multiple arms looking at different assets with clearance of ctDNA as primary endpoint. So it's a signal-seeking study to look at different outcome, and it's an immunotherapy trial. And we have looked at immunotherapy in this setting for multiple reasons. There, as you've seen, and we have built a number of evidence, accumulative evidence showing that immunotherapy would work and may work better in certain biologies for colorectal cancer, particularly the population that do not have liver metastasis. And patients with minimal residual disease are a typical population that immunotherapy may work well in it because there's no evidence of, it's kind of stage 4, not yet found. So no obvious evidence of liver metastasis in this population. So we designed this as an immunotherapy platform study. So we have an arm, a control arm looking at PD-1 monotherapy, and then combination arms looking at PD-1 in combination with LAG-3 inhibitor. And then we also have an arm with PD-1 inhibitor in combo with EGFR bispecific T-cell engager.
I mean, it's such a great type of study to offer to a patient. I usually have to tear myself away from talking about cell-free DNA, so I'm just going to do one more question back to Arvin, actually a double question. So Dr. Rudolph, give me a little follow-up in the chat room. This patient who developed positive ctDNA after stage 2, had peritoneal mets, got 12 cycles of FOLFOX, and now the ctDNA is negative, Arvin, and the CT is imaging is negative. She wants to know, could you consider stopping therapy? And I want to throw in another question because Anwar brought up the issue of oligometastatic disease. Do you use cell-free DNA in, you know, liver-only mets that get resected, for example?
Yeah, starting with the patient case, it's great that the patient has had such a phenomenal response, and it's also gratifying to see that the patient has had not only a negative ctDNA assay but negative imaging. The thing to remember is these assays, while having very, very high specificity and positive predictive value, have somewhat limited sensitivity. And that limited sensitivity is driven by the amount of tumor that we're dealing with, the tumor burden, and also the site of spread. For instance, small lung mets and peritoneal disease, especially low volume, could be falsely negative. And as we know, so can imaging also be negative in this situation. So stopping therapy would need a detailed discussion, both with the patient as well as in a multidisciplinary setting, to see whether additional evaluations, such as with a diagnostic laparoscopy, might be warranted to be absolutely sure that clinical complete response is indeed translating into a pathological complete response.
What about cell-free DNA status post hepatic resection of oligomets?
Yeah, absolutely. We tend to do these testing during surveillance for these patients. The goal is to, enroll these patients onto trials, such as what Anwar is leading. And there are some accumulating data that suggests that perhaps, maybe, you could capture recurrences early on where it's still oligometastatic and do a curative intervention at that stage.
So I'm going to tear myself away from cell-free DNA, move on to something I think is even as fascinating, checkpoint inhibitors in metastatic disease. And Anwar, you know, we're at the, I mentioned the SGO meeting this past weekend. We also did a program on ovarian cancer. And there, after many trials that were negative, looking at IOs in ovarian cancer and MS-stable ovarian cancer, finally at ESMO, there was a positive trial. It actually got approved. It was Pembro plus chemo. We actually had the principal investigator there, Dr. Nicoletta Colombo, to talk about it. And we were saying, hey, you know, this coming Thursday, we've got the principal investigator of a breakthrough study in MS-stable colon cancer as well. So we have two areas of oncology, important areas of common tumors, where it looks like maybe IOs are going to come in. But let's start out with MSI-high metastatic disease. And Anwar, in your talk, you went through the KEYNOTE-177 study comparing Pembro to chemotherapy that I think everybody is familiar with, as well as the CheckMate 8HW that brought in Ipi-Nivo as an important advance for these patients who can tolerate it. And then you also talked about this study with atezolizumab, which was interesting in MSI, which was atezolizumab alone combined with chemotherapy, where it looked like you got a little extra bump there by adding the chemo. So I guess my question to you is, how do you think through clinically right now with this data, Anwar, your MSI-high metastatic patients? What are the situations where you will or will not use Ipi-Nivo, or, you know, in terms of comorbidities, particularly autoimmune or immune comorbidities? What about giving chemo, or you use just IO alone?
Yeah, so good question. So I think, you know, I typically go by the phase three evidence, and I think we have clear phase three evidence from both the KEYNOTE study and the CheckMate study that immunotherapy without chemo is a solid approach in patients with MSI high advanced stage disease in the frontline setting. And the CheckMate trial with nivolumab plus ipilimumab that came as a subsequent study to the KEYNOTE trial showed that adding the CTLA-4 inhibitor to PD-1 inhibitor is superior to PD-1 inhibitor alone. And I think that's the difference. The Kaplan Meier curve of that study is really hard to neglect, and so I think it's the addition or the IO approach is very solid approach in this disease, and so I in my real world practice, if I don't have any contraindication to an IO, that's my go to strategy. I still use pembrolizumab alone for certain scenarios, particularly in patients where I feel the risk of immunotherapy related adverse events is high. For example, patients who have chronic autoimmune diseases, who have stable chronic autoimmune disease but have high risk of flare ups with the aggressive IO approach. So in this population, I use Pembro alone. Similar population in this category will be patients who have old or prior history of transplant, patients, frail patients who may not tolerate immunotherapy related adverse events, and so I use monotherapy with pembrolizumab in those categories.
What about Anwar, though, a patient who is fit but does have an autoimmune problem, so you don't want to give Ipi-Nivo? Would you give IO alone, or based on the paper that you discussed there where you saw an extra bump there with chemo, consider adding in chemo?
I would use IO alone. I mean, I'm not sure if I will use chemo IO just because the study, I think the study is showing really good progression-free survival data, but the overall survival was not significant. I think we still need a larger size study to kind of validate what was seen in the COMET study. The COMET study was terminated early, so the sample size is small. There was a change in the design while the study is ongoing. So it utilized a PD-L1 inhibitor as opposed to the PD-1 inhibitors in all the other MSI high studies. And so I think that there's it brought a lot of open questions to the table that to me, I think requires validation and larger data set, whether retrospective or prospective. But I don't think in real world practice I would endorse adding chemo to IO when immunotherapy alone can lead to a really good outcome.
Arvind, anything you want to add to that or anything to say? I find, you know, so often investigators really they echo each other very closely. We see a lot of homogeneity in how investigators approach issues. Anything about what's anything you quibble with Anwar about her discussion about how she approaches first-line therapy of metastatic MSI disease, Arvind?
Now, all I'm going to say is I echo with what both of you said, that kind of there's a lot of synergy across kind of KOLs and how we approach the setting and what Anwar said.
Incidentally, Dr. Rudolph says, thank you very much for your input. She also loves ChatGPT, but agrees that it makes mistakes sometimes. Also, Arvind, Theodora says she has a patient with mucinous adenocarcinoma of the appendix, stage 2, resected with infiltration into surrounding tissues that she's following with monthly Signatera. What do we know about Signatera or cell-free DNA assays in appendiceal cancer, Arvind?
Yeah, especially in a mucinous tumor type where a lot of the findings that we're seeing on the scans are not necessarily active cancer cells, but just the mucin. Very likely the amount of cancer that's actually shedding ctDNA might be very low. So unless they've had a positive ctDNA assay previously, I'd be hesitant to make major treatment decisions based solely on the ctDNA assay results.
And a couple of people in the chat were asking me whether I use Open Evidence. Of course, Open Evidence is another great AI resource as well, particularly to look up papers and stuff. All right, let's get to what really exciting, another exciting advance, I think, here. Here's another. We see press releases all the time. They're so informative. So now the FDA has accepted a new drug application for zanzalintinib. And first of all, can you talk a little bit, Anwar, about what we understand about, this is a TKI, obviously, a VEGF TKI, but how it compares to other VEGF targeting agents and other TKIs?
Yeah, so zanzalintinib is it's a next-generation VEGF tyrosine, multi-VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitor that is, I would say, next generation of the parent drug that's called cabozantinib. As you know, cabozantinib is approved in other solid tumor types. So this is a next generation with the closely, I would say, not completely, but closely similar tyrosine targets to cabozantinib. However, both of those agents, and talking about zanzalintinib here, it is different than the other tyrosine kinase inhibitors in the market, namely lenvatinib, regorafenib, and the other drugs you mentioned here as far as monoclonal antibodies. And that the tyrosine, zanzalintinib and cabozantinib are one of the, I would say, only TKIs that that's there that target the TAM kinases in addition to MET and AXL. I think, you know, when looking at the targets for lenvatinib and regorafenib, MET and AXL is not there. The TAM kinases are different. So it is unique. It's a unique VEGF multi-tyrosine kinase inhibitor when referring to those specific targets. And those specific targets have relevance to the colorectal cancer space and some other GI cancer spaces as well.
So actually, speaking of TKIs, another trial of the year that I didn't see on ChatGPT was the zongertinib first-line study in HER2 mutant lung cancer. Incredible results there. We're talking about TKIs and the potential there. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the Stellar 303 study, what it looked at, what it found, Anwar, and what your thoughts are in terms of clinical relevance?
Yeah, so Stellar 303 was a phase 3 study looking at or tailored to the microsatellite stable population of colorectal cancer patients who have advanced stage disease who progressed or intolerant to prior standard of care therapy, mainly failed the frontline and second line setting, and including exposure to prior targeted therapy if they are RAS wild type or BRAF mutant. And the patients in this study received either zanzalintinib plus atezo or rigorafenib. Rigorafenib was the control arm. The study met its primary endpoint of overall survival. So the median overall survival was around 11 months in the investigational arm. As you see in the Kaplan-Meier curve, there is a separation of the curve that remain separated beyond 24 months with a 10% difference at the 24 months median overall survival. The positive, I would say, or significant hazard ratio. Similarly, for progression-free survival, there was a significant hazard ratio of 0.68. When looking at overall survival subgroups, the study showed that there is a consistent survival advantage in most of the important subgroups, including patients with or without liver metastasis and patients who have prior exposure to VEGF-targeted therapy, which is a positive thing when historically comparing that to the sunlight data with TAS-102 plus bevacizumab. As far as the safety, or summarizing the safety, the studies show a larger capture of grade 3 and above toxicity with the regimen when comparing that to rigorafenib alone. There is a larger immunotherapy-related adverse event seen with as expected with the investigational regimen as opposed to the control arm. However, there are some, I would say, dose-limiting toxicities that was seen much lower with zanzalintinib arm as opposed to rigorafenib, namely the hand-foot syndrome was much lower with this agent compared to Rigo.
I was just going to say, for people who are listening in the gym or whatever, if you look at that big orange thing going to the right for regorafenib is hand-foot syndrome, which, of course, is really, I think people would be happy to have an alternative to regorafenib. And also, Arvin, when you think about it, I remember hearing about, I think it was regorafenib and Nevo that we had some excitement about in MS-stable disease, and that sort of crashed a little bit. Before Anwar continues, anything you want to say about what you think is going on here, Arvin, why we're seeing this benefit? Do you think it's about the TKI or the way the study was done? Is this evidence enough for you to want to do it? If this were approved, Arvin, would you utilize it?
Yeah, I think really compelling data. And as you pointed out, prior studies were not truly conclusive of whether this approach of immunotherapy in microsatellite stable colorectal cancer patients would pan out or not. And this is the first study really saying that, yes, this is a valid approach, this is active and provides benefit to the patients. And building on this, there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of buzz, a lot of excitement on doing more trials with immunotherapy in patients with microsatellite stable colorectal cancer. I do think that this would be taken up by the community and used after it's approved. And as Anwar pointed out, there are some kind of differences in toxicities as compared to regorafenib, some more, some better with this combination. So I suspect what's going to happen is perhaps also as we get more familiar with this regimen, some real world tweaking of the dosing to make it more palatable for patients.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I don't know if you've looked at it in the control arm with the regorafenib. I'd be curious to know whether people are doing any better now than they did 5 years ago maybe more than that when regorafenib came up. And, you know, people had such terrible toxicity, nobody wanted to use it. Then we had, you know, Tony Saab and they changed the dosing there. Anything, and here are your conclusions about the study. Anwar, I don't think you want to add anything to it, if you want to add anything. Also, you bring up the issue of what about TAS-102 and Bev? Do you need to compare that? Is that going to be done? Anything else you want to say about the study, Anwar?
No, I think, I think the results are, in terms of overall survival, to me is solid. It's a very large, well-controlled, randomized study, well-balanced group, and the largest, I would say, immunotherapy trial historically that was done in the chemo-refractory space. So I think it is. It's justifying the use of this regimen. I would like to add that the study has another primary endpoint looking at the population of patients who do not have liver metastasis. And that endpoint, we're looking at the mature data from that subgroup. Around 40% of the patients that enrolled into this trial were patients who do not have liver metastasis, and their data is still maturing. And so we're hoping to have the data out hopefully later this year. And I think that will add or solidify the outcome seen in this study already. And we've seen larger effect in this population compared to the subgroup of patients with liver metastasis, even though there was a significant outcome regardless of liver versus non-liver, but a larger delta with this in this subgroup. So we're hoping to that will continue and show significance on the when the mature results are presented.
Yeah, I don't know if you have patient-reported outcomes, but it'll be interesting too. Again, comparing to regorafenib, based, anti-tumor benefit, maybe less toxicity. Another thing we just want to ask you about too, Anwaar. I was mentioning we did this webinar on Tuesday on small cell cancer, and there, several years ago, trials came out looking at IO and extensive stage disease. People started using it because there was a benefit. It got approved with two IOs, but nobody was too excited because median survival was still like about 13 months. And then as time went on, they saw there's a tail on the curve. Maybe 12-15% of people are out 5 years and doing well. So even over the overall group, it wasn't that impressive. There were these people who did really well, which they had never seen before with extensive stage. You were mentioning that you think there's a look, the beginning of what looks like a tail on the curve of STELLAR-303. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there was a 10% difference between the two arms at the 24 months cutoff. That was censored data, so we still need to look at the long-term data to comment on the tail, but there is already kind of tail showing there. I think given the size of the study being 900 patients, it enabled us to run a number of molecular studies to look at subgroups. I think there will be other, I would say, correlative analysis and papers that will come out of this STELLAR-303 trial to highlight the population that would benefit the most. So I think the patients with no liver metastasis is one of them, but no one know really why exactly why those patients are doing. Is there a molecular subtype driving those anatomic sites, for example, and might be easy to test in clinic. So I think more to come from this study.
So, final comment from Arvind. I mean, I think patients and docs like the idea of IOs because there's this hope that maybe you're going to see some long-term survival when you see tails in the curve that are, kind of low, 12, 20, 50% or so. You wonder, is it really there or not? Do you think there are people built in here who really do have sensitivity to IOs and maybe are even being cured?
Yeah. So as Anwaar pointed out, the probably the biomarker that we are using the most to design clinical trials currently is a rather crude one, presence of liver mets versus not. We still don't know what's different about the tumor microenvironment or circulating cytokines and patients with and without liver mets. I think kind of building on that observation and also trying to find other biomarkers, as Anwaar pointed out, would be kind of other very critical and vital contributions of the study that the field is really looking forward to.
So it's a happy day when you can't get through all the great news in one cancer in an hour. We have like seven other papers we never got to, but you can check it out on these presentations from the faculty. Anwaar and Arvind, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for tuning in. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Anwar. Arvind, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.